Resolute Square.
There was also maintained what was called an enemies list, which was rather extensive and continually being updated.
Democrats want Republicans dead.
Where I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and I wouldn't lose any voters, okay?
The women with the least likelihood of getting pregnant are the ones most worried about having abortions.
On January 6th of 2021, you had tens of thousands of people peacefully protesting.
No, it's not a right-wing conspiracy theory. It's not QAnon. It's real.
I'm Rick Wilson, and this is The Enemies List.
We are joined today on The Enemies List by a great reporter, a clear thinker, a smart person. You will really enjoy this conversation. It's Charlotte Alter from Time Magazine. She is one of their lead writers in an area that intersects with politics and culture and looks at where we're at with a very honest view. So Charlotte, thank you so much for coming on The Enemies List today.
Rick, thanks so much for having me.
I wanted to start out, you wrote a piece about a week ago that I really enjoyed called The Dread Election. And it's this sense that this election is going to be sort of equally consequential and horrible in equal measures. Talk to us a little bit about what you're seeing and hearing out there in the world from folks who are looking at the next 34 weeks that are ahead of us.
Yeah. So, I mean, this piece really came about because I've, you know, for years now, I have been reporting on what's happening among sort of elected political leaders, but also on sort of the, you know, what used to be called the resistance, but basically kind of this vast world of people who are very involved in politics, but aren't actually elected to anything. They're not actually like on anybody's staff. They are sort of organizers and activists. So I've been very plugged into this scene for years now. And as this election ramped up, I kept, you know, calling my sources and saying, hey, you know, when are you getting started? What's happening? And everything I heard from everybody was like, oh, we hate this. Oh, kill me now. In fact, one of my sources in the story texted me, I wish for death. And so at first I was like, oh my God, you know, how there's not a story, like how am I going to report on this if like nobody's doing anything? There's not a story if nothing's happening. But then I sort of realized that this persistent sense of like doom and gloom and dread and sort of this sick feeling that people seem to have in their stomach, I thought it was the obstacle to the story, but I actually think it is the story, at least, you know, for people who are working to oppose Donald Trump.
Yeah, I think that's right. This sense with a lot of folks in the pro-democracy, anti-Trump, never-Trump space, whatever you want to call it, there is this sort of all ongoing sense of, oh God, we have to do this all over again. Why does no one learn their lesson? Why can't people figure this out? And it really, I mean, because I am famously a ray of sunshine, I'm always telling people like, you will never learn because it has to, you can't make an accommodation with this kind of thing, this really dark authoritarian movement that will do anything to win. And people think we're going to run a regular campaign based on policy. What? No,
no. Yeah, no. But you know, I'm hearing from people, which is like, it's in some ways it's very personally challenging because I'm hearing from people who say, listen, you know, when Trump was elected in 2016, I put my whole life on hold. I stopped spending as much time with my kids. I sacrificed all of my nights and weekends to phone calls, to phone banking, to canvassing, whatever, anything to try to elect Democrats and try to stop Donald Trump. I've devoted my whole life to this. And now he's back and potentially stronger than ever.
You know, the odd thing about Trump in 2024 from my perspective is this is a guy who is, yes, he's stronger than ever. He has a tighter control over the party. He has more vulnerabilities than ever. I think there's a differential. Maybe you see this too. There's a sort of differential in a passion differential between the people on the left who fear Trump and in the center who fear Trump and think he's going to be a bad outcome. Versus his people, it's almost a sort of messianic, like we must return him to power or we all die. It is a, like there's an intensity gap between the two factions.
Yeah. And one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot as this election unfolds is sort of, you know, we are really conditioned in American politics, I think, particularly since the 2008 election of Barack Obama, to draw a really straight line between enthusiasm and political outcomes. And to say, you know, the person with the most enthusiastic base, the person who has the most absolute devotion among their voters, that's going to be the person who's going to win the election. And I actually think that 2022 and potentially 2024 could complicate that, I don't want to say algorithm or, you know, political algebra, right, let's call it, a little bit, because I do think that there are a lot of people, and in fact, I think this is ultimately what blunted the so-called red wave in 2022. There are a lot of people who are, you know, for example, in Arizona, not out there really excited about Katie Hobbs.
No.
Not out there where, you know, loving what Katie Hobbs is selling, but they see Carrie Lake, or they saw Carrie Lake in 2022, and they said, oh my God, this is scary. And even though they weren't enthusiastic about Katie Hobbs, they got out and voted for her anyway, and Carrie Lake is not the governor of Arizona right now. So this election has the potential to complicate that assumption that, you know, the person who has the most enthusiastic base is necessarily the person who's going to win the election.
Yeah, I mean, and it's like the negative partisanship runs into a negative intensity with a lot of these people. And I do think you're right that 22, what's one thing we exploited a lot in 22 to help, you know, we won 17 out of our 22 races we targeted that year, in part by going after, you know, holding up the edge cases, the Carrie Lakes, the Doug Mastrianos, as a mirror to a lot of these voters. And it managed to shave off enough of them, you know, between 7% and 11%, depending on the state, at the last minute. But I mean, I think it's interesting because you end up with a lot of groups that are more or less amenable to that. And they tend to be the folks we've modeled for a long time. And we don't do a lot of young voter targeting at Lincoln, because that's not really our demo. That's not really the people we're talking to that we're skilled at talking to the best. You've done a lot of reporting and thinking about young voters this year and about their consequence in American elections right now, and how young leaders are coming up, and how there's a new generation coming up. And I'm curious where you think a lot of them stand, because on the Democratic side, they appear to be a little more conflicted than I think the Biden campaign would like. On the Republican side, they appear to be a little more fascist than America would like. But tell me about what you're seeing and hearing out there about younger voters this cycle.
I think the really important thing to remember about young voters and what makes them distinct from other blocks of voters that people typically talk about, you know, people have an analysis of Black voters, or people have an analysis of suburban voters, or, you know, of white evangelical voters, is that every cycle, this cohort of voters is different, because the under 30 voter who voted in, let's say, 2018, where there was a surge of youth voter turnout for Democrats in 2018, many of those voters are in their 30s now. They've aged. They are now 32, 33, 34, whatever. They are not the same under 30 voters that we see right now. So this is not a static group, because they're defined by age. And age, as much as we would like it to stay the same over time, it doesn't. I've actually seen a pretty significant shift over the course of now, you know, almost 8 years reporting on young voters, because in the beginning of the Trump era, the youngest two cohorts of voters, let's say, like, you know, the under 30s and maybe like also the under 40s, they were people who had been defined by the Obama era. You know, many of them had cast their first presidential vote for Barack Obama, who was like hugely popular with young people. And they had a very distinct perspective, because one of the things that I've learned in covering this, and one of the things that my book is about, is that for most people, the events of early adulthood are extremely important for forming your lifelong political attitudes. The things that you see and experience in your first, let's say, 10 years of being kind of awake in the world. So like, not something that happened when you were 5 years old, maybe, but not necessarily something that happens in your 20s, you know, things that happen when you're 17, 18, 19, when you're first beginning to experience the world as an adult. Those are the things that have a lifelong impact on your political leanings. So for many millennials, and I want to be clear here, millennials are not 21 years old.
No, they're not.
Millennials are in their 30s and early 40s now. So for many millennials, you know, those events largely happened, you know, started at, let's say, 9/11 and traced through to, you know, around the time that Barack Obama's presidency was happening and Donald Trump was about to be elected. For Gen Z, those events are the Trump presidency. So they are in some ways used to a lot more activism and upheaval and anger and outrage, chaos. And one of the things that I'm hearing from the younger voters that I'm talking to is an extreme dissatisfaction with Joe Biden, mostly on the subject of Gaza. And they are sort of unswayed by the argument that a lot of older people make that, you know, I'm sure if you know a younger person, you're probably pulling your hair out about this. I'm finding people are kind of unswayed by like the, but Trump is going to be president. Trump is bad. You know, they're not buying. It's not that they don't believe that that's true. It's not that they support Trump. They are just so angry about what's happening in Gaza that they think, at least the ones that I've been talking to, many of them say that they think that this sort of, this election is a little bit of a distraction from that. They think the Trump question is like a whataboutism. I don't agree with that. I'm not defending that perspective, but that is what I'm hearing from them.
Support for Rick Wilson's The Enemies List comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/Wilson. That's odoo.com/Wilson. Odoo, modern management made simple. I do think there's a degree of like the best being the enemy of the good with a lot of younger voters right now. I mean, and I know the whataboutism thing is something that I have heard that same argument, but it's like, what do they think is going to happen in Gaza with the Palestinians if Donald Trump is elected? Well, I mean, do they really believe that it's going to be exactly the same outcome? Because if Donald Trump is elected, he's going to call Bibi up and say, pave it over, kill them all, and make it into a water park. It's hard for me to understand like how they don't get that part of the equation.
That's the challenge here, right? It's not as if Joe Biden is running against a ceasefire candidate who is, really a strong advocate for Palestinian rights. I also think we have to look at this in the context, and I hate to bring this up because this is like, you know, such a dead horse of a topic, but I do think that the idea of cancel culture is sort of relevant here. You know, the idea that your worst act, your worst position, the worst thing you did or do outweighs all of the other things that you do. And this is younger people are the ones who have tended to be quicker to judge and slower to forgive in this context, quicker to cancel, slower to rehabilitate. And I just think that there is an attraction to moral purity among this generation. And I think that's part of what we're seeing here. The thing that concerns me the most about it, here's the thing that concerns me the most about it, is that I think many of these activists that I'm talking to your point about Trump's position on Israel, many of the activists who I'm talking to who are know about this are ultimately going to vote for Joe Biden. I think they will. They're going to be really loudly grumpy about it, and they're going to criticize him, and they're going to organize, and they're going to protest, but they are going to vote for Joe Biden. The problem is that what's happening now is there has been a chilling effect on support for Biden among your sort of normal young person online, your TikTok person, your Instagram person, whatever. It is harder for somebody to come out and say, I'm so excited to vote for Joe Biden in 2024 because that person is going to get flooded with comments about Gaza. And that is reminding some people a lot of what happened to Hillary Clinton in 2016, where her supporters, they were there, but to come out online and say, I love Hillary Clinton, I'm so excited to vote for her, like join me on election day voting for Hillary Clinton, you'd be mocked. And so people were doing it in secret. They were these secret Facebook groups of women who were so excited about Hillary, but they weren't really sharing it with their networks. And I think that's the danger for the Biden campaign right now, is that the situation in Gaza has created a chilling effect on his support among the younger voters who, by the way, put him over the top in the five key states that he needs to win this election.
You know, it's interesting you talk about that, because that is one of the things that I've started to see, like, pinging in the radar of millennial and Gen Z, older Gen Z voters now. There is that younger voter cohort that does believe in ideological purity, and you can never have a wrong mark on your report card. You can never have a violation of, you know, for lack of a better phrase, the political correctness code. And I'm fascinated that there does seem to be, as the millennials start to age up, and that some of the older Gen Zs, there is a certain like, okay, I think we've gone a little too far on some of this. There's a certain like, I don't want to get canceled, and they're sort of feeling like that aspect of younger culture is starting to push a little too hard. And I think the Republicans are also smartly kind of exploiting that with working class voters in those two cohorts at the same time, where they're saying, don't say the wrong word or you'll be canceled and you'll never work again, etc.
When I talk to younger Republicans, they're not saying, oh, I'm conservative because I want lower taxes, or I'm conservative because my fiscal policy is this, or, you know, one of the main things at this point attracting younger people to the conservative movement and the Republican Party is a rejection of so-called cancel culture, this, you know, everything that goes along with that. I mean, you know, all of the phrases that we used to talk about, this become immediately outdated, but so-called wokeism or whatever, a rejection of that is one of the only things that is driving younger people towards, you know, the more conservative end of the political spectrum.
I see that running up the younger voter right side of the equation dialogue. And they're not even, it's not like these guys are like a bunch of alt-righters or hyper right-wing or Christian nationalists. It's this sense among middle-class and working-class people in again, late Gen Z or early Gen Z, or early millennials, late Gen Zs, that the monster that's been sort of setting the rules for them for a long time is out of control, and that they feel like that they're at risk now on that, and they can't say or do anything. It's not that they want to go out and yell the N-word. It's that they're worried about. I mean, I was in a focus group a few years ago, and a guy said, I guess the pronoun thing scares the hell out of me all the time. I just don't know. I'm not that guy. I'm not a bad guy. I don't have anything against LGBT people. But if I put the wrong pronoun in an email, am I going to get, you know, the call from HR? And it's, you know, I think that is a legitimate fear in the minds of a lot of people, that the mechanical side of that enforcement ends up opening a political door that the Republicans have been kind of smart about trying to drive through.
Yeah. And I think that's really interesting. And also one of the things that I've been really curious about is where this came from, really. Right. And one of the things that I found in thinking a lot about it and in sort of trying to understand why this generation is so much more, more likely to think this way is that actually, if you back to the idea of, you know, political ideas kind of germinating long before you're a real political actor. You know, it's these were the first generations that grew up with zero tolerance bullying policies in schools. So in the 1980s and 90s, that was the first time. I don't know if you remember this, Rick, but that was the first time that, like, you know, if one kid pushed another kid on the playground, they could get expelled from school. Like, there was a whole push around bullying and, you know, kids were getting bullied too much. And all of these schools implemented these zero tolerance crackdown policies of like one strike, you're out. You get, and if you call your classmate a name, you're suspended for 2 weeks. You, you know, go like pow, pow, pow on the playground with your hand. You could have some, you know, detention that means you never go to recess again or something, whatever. Extreme punishments for relatively small infractions, right? And, you know, that had tremendous implications for Black and brown kids in particular, because a lot of those kids ended up getting funneled into the criminal justice system. And there were huge inequities that came downstream from that, vast inequities that came downstream from that. And also, it affected basically everybody who went to school at that time, because it was this idea that one thing that you do, you could, if you do one thing wrong, you could be punished for ever in kid mind, you know?
The old joke about it being, you know, this will go down on your permanent record. It really did become something like that, that wrecked a lot of people's worlds, I guess.
So I don't think that's a coincidence that that the same kids who kind of grew up with these like really draconian consequences in school for like basically being normal kids are now, you know, are now the architects of what a lot of people, you know, wonder is this like sort of too harsh of a world a little bit. Is this a world that allows anybody to make a mistake?
It's like young men, like the high spirits of young men. It's not something patriarchal or awful. It's just biology ended up getting in a wedge in a lot of those policies. And so I think that's why there may be, again, that there's that opening the Republicans are exploiting. I don't know how to fix it, but it is certainly something that people shouldn't ignore. I want to talk to you a little bit about who you see coming up on both sides as younger leaders now in both parties that you think, because you know the geriatric election we're engaged in right now, and let's, you know, there's no other way to phrase it. There's no other way to deal with it. Is the last election we will ever have with two boomers in it? That's it. We're done.
I don't even think Joe Biden's a boomer. I think Donald Trump is like a very early boomer.
Technically, yeah, they're like the ragged early edge of that. But we're never going to see an election from anybody who remembers the 1960s again as a candidate, in any meaningful way. Who do you see coming up in the wings? Look, the Republicans always have a bias for slightly older candidates as a general rule, but you know, the Democrats have not had that bias in the past. Who do you see coming up that people should keep an eye on?
Yeah, I mean, well, one of the things that I see, frankly, is a huge imbalance between the parties, because I think Democrats, since Trump was elected, have actually done a very good job of supporting and cultivating younger, exciting candidates on the state and local level who have tremendous potential. You know, I'm thinking about people like State Senator Mallory McMorrow, who is a Michigan state senator who, you know, has a really bright future in Michigan. You know, I think people know the name Gretchen Whitmer, but they don't know the name Mallory McMorrow. And she is very much sort of in the same vein as Gretchen Whitmer. I'm thinking of people like Ruben Gallego, who's currently running for Senate in Arizona.
He's a friend. Absolutely. Yep.
Like Lauren Underwood, who is a congresswoman from Illinois. And, you know, actually in 2018, there was a tremendous surge of young, diverse Democrats who were running. And I want to be clear, you know, I think AOC, for example, is part of this cohort. I think she's actually proven herself to be a very skilled politician since she won that race. But I'm also thinking about young Democrats who are not the AOCs of the world, who are running in moderate or even conservative districts. I'm thinking of Alyssa Slotkin, who's a congresswoman from Michigan. She's running for Senate, who are not sort of your fire-breathing progressive activists, but are like smart, pragmatic, patriotic American public servants who are putting in their time and have a really bright future ahead. And I think one of the big problems that the Republican Party has is that they had a lot of young talent, and a lot of that young talent has left, or they have turned so full MAGA that they are not going to be able to cleanse themselves of that stain when this fever breaks, which who knows when that will be.
I watched AOC interestingly evolve in the last 2 years, where I think some of her initial star power, I think it went to her head at first. I think it got her a little overhyped at first, but she seems to have gotten some steadiness and a sort of maturity about her now. Is she still a far left progressive? Absolutely. But she's not as hot a flavor as she was. And I think she's starting to play the game a little bit and understand how to become a more effective leader than she was.
Yeah. I think you're totally right. And I think AOC, I mean, I've always thought that AOC is one of the best communicators that the Democratic Party has seen since Barack Obama. She is, you know, when she went on TV recently, I forget the exact date, it was in the last couple of weeks, and somebody asked her a question about, you know, is Joe Biden too old? She said, well, Donald Trump's the same age. You know, they probably went to high school together. I'm surprised that nobody else in the Democratic Party is making that argument. That is obviously one of the best messaging points that could be a retort to questions about the president's age. So she's always been a fantastic communicator, but I agree with you that she really, it seems like, has kind of developed some more real political chops in the last couple of years, and sort of has a better understanding of like building allies, building coalitions, what to compromise on, what to not compromise on. And I think she's going to be around for a while. I think people who discounted her immediately as being kind of a flash in the pan, I think they're going to be proven wrong, because I actually think she may have real staying power.
She was initially branded with the squad. None of them are ever going anywhere politically. Again, I don't have to agree with her on stuff. I just think she has a much broader appeal than she did 2 years ago, because she's well presented and she's starting to be able to like actually sit down and do the lifting of being a legislator and not just being, you know, a social media star, which, you know, contrary to popular belief, kids, you still have to do the work.
I think that's absolutely true. Yeah.
Well, what else are you watching for in the coming election, Charlotte, as we wrap up today?
I am really trying to keep an eye out for where this potential silent majority is, because I do think that one of the things I learned in the last couple elections, and I think this is probably true of most elections, is that in some ways, the smarter you are about politics, the dumber you are about politics, because the voters who, the let's say 40,000 voters who decide presidential elections, are probably not, you know, diving into the crosstabs of a February Times.
No, they're not.
Poll. You know what I mean? You know, they are living their lives. They're going to their kids' basketball games. They're whatever, you know? And so I think it's really important for anybody who is thinking about this and covering this to in some ways put a lens over their eyes of like, okay, imagine I don't care. What do I think about this if I don't care? You right. know?
Think about me as someone with no Fs to give.
Yes, right. Like, imagine I don't care about politics. I have better things to do in my life. What is breaking through to me? So that's one of the things that I'm really trying to look at. And I think one of the challenges for Biden and Harris is that they are doing a lot of explaining about their accomplishments. And it sounds to a lot of people like a lot of policy jargon. And I worry that they have not yet found a message that's like really cutting through to the people. Again, the people who care about politics, no. It's the people who don't care about politics who decide the election. And so it's like, what is breaking through to them? So that's what I'm trying to, that's one of the things that I think really only, you can only find out by talking to a lot of people. And hopefully I'll be able to do that this cycle.
Thank you so much today, Charlotte, for coming on The Enemies List. We really appreciate your time. Look forward to talking to you again soon. Tell folks where they can find you on social media.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me, Rick. I love this show and it's an honor to be on. Yeah, so you can follow me on X, I guess it's called now, at Charlotte Alter.
I will die before I call it X.
I know. I write for Time. And my book, which came out a couple years ago, is called The Ones We've Been Waiting For, How a New Generation of Leaders Will Transform America. And it gets into a lot of what we've talked about here.
Terrific. Well, thanks again so much. And we will talk to you again very soon.
I hope so. Thanks, Rick.
Let's be very clear about something. I'm 60 years old. I am not the TikTok demo. But if you spent years saying that TikTok was the root of all evil, that it was secretly controlled by the Chi-Coms, that TikTok was magically going to turn a generation of young Americans into eager young communists following the Red Book of Mao, and also cause them to become trans, Sharia law pursuing, cannibal whatevers. And now you're suddenly in favor of TikTok? Get the fuck out of here. Because here's the deal, folks. The idea that TikTok is suddenly a good thing, after you've been saying for years that TikTok was a risk, is amazing. Who's the king of this? Donald Trump. Why did Donald Trump suddenly become pro-TikTok? Because he's a whore. That's something that, I'm just going to use the word, it's not even advisedly. Donald Trump is doing things for money. And he is doing this work for TikTok now because a billionaire named Jeff Yass, who, by the way, is a whole separate kettle of weird. He's a guy based out of Philadelphia, out of Pennsylvania, who is a billionaire. He's got his own super PACs. He's involved in all kinds of this weird right-wing stuff. But Jeff Yass threw Donald Trump a bunch of money. And like we know, Donald Trump will do anything for money. Suddenly, Trump is in favor of TikTok. And suddenly, Kellyanne Conway is out lobbying for TikTok. Suddenly, there's a whole army of people who were so against TikTok when Donald Trump wanted to ban TikTok. But now that Donald Trump's been paid a chunk of money by Jeff Yass, who happens to be, call me crazy, an investor in ByteDance, the company that owns TikTok, now TikTok's the good guys? Y'all are on the enemies list. And in the tradition of the TikTok thing, I'm sure there's some funny little dance to go with it. But I'm 60 years old. I'm a white fat guy, and I'm not doing any damn dances. But you are on the enemies list.
Thanks again for listening to The Enemies List. If you have any comments, questions, or if there's someone you'd like to hear on the podcast, hit me up on Twitter at TheRickWilson. Thanks again for the wonderful support you've shown the pod. We're growing fast. It really helps if you will share this with your friends, your family, and anyone else who, like us, is trying to save democracy. While you're at it, if you could rate and review the podcast, I would be very much appreciative. I know this is the sort of thing you've heard a billion times. Please rate, review, like, blah, blah, blah. But you need to do it. It really does help us a lot. We are slaves to the algorithm, my friends. And if you do this, it will help get the pod out further. Anyway, thanks again for listening. I'll see you next time. And remember, whatever you do, stay off the list.